This week on the Electronic Intifada podcast, how Israel's war industry profits from violent U.S. immigration reform. We'll speak with our contributor Gabriel Chavone in Arizona about a Senate-approved bill which guarantees more deaths along the U.S.-Mexico border and huge payouts to Israeli contractors, whose military technology has been, quote, battle-proven on Palestinians living under occupation.
I mean, there are lots of global actors who are helping the United States to smash undocumented migrant communities and communities of color and border communities. But Israel is a major one, which is just growing and growing and growing.
And 66 years ago, Zionist terrorist militias massacred more than 100 Palestinians in the Jerusalem village of Deir Yassin. Dina Elmouti recounts her recent visit with her grandmother to the site of the massacre. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, associate editor for the Electronic Intifada in Oakland. We begin in Arizona. Immigrant rights advocates in the U.S. organized a National Day of Action on April 5th, the day they expected President Barack Obama's record-breaking rate of deportations to reach a total of 2 million during his administration. But scant attention has been paid to the list of global benefactors awaiting the profits from legislation escalating border militarization. Our next guest, journalist and activist Gabriel Chavone, writes in an article on the Electronic Intifada that Israel tops the lineup of patrons eager for rewards, while advocates demanding a meaningful overhaul of U.S. immigration and border enforcement continue their defiant battle in the streets. In this setting, rights supporters must know which global partners stand beside the U.S. in repressing undocumented immigrant communities. But how does the situation in Palestine, thousands of miles away, affect U.S. immigration reform and vice versa? What does one have to do with the other? Quite a lot, actually, finds Chavone. A bill passed in the Senate last June, but so far stalled in the House of Representatives, seeks to set aside $46 billion for so-called security triggers that must be in place in areas including Arizona before a pathway to citizenship can be opened for an estimated 11 million people living undocumented in the U.S. today. The recent signing of a contract now worth $145 million with the Israeli company Elbit Systems to further militarize the wall at the U.S.-Mexico border may eventually reach $1 billion if legislation to rewrite U.S. immigration laws passes Congress and helps fund the project's expansion in the Southwest, according to Bloomberg News. Our guest and contributor to the Electronic Intifada, Gabriel Chavone, is a youth organizer with UNIDOS, an indigenous-based ethnic studies group in Tucson, Arizona, and an ad hoc steering committee member of National Students for Justice in Palestine. I began by asking him to lay out the significance of the Senate bill and the role of Israeli security corporations and weapons manufacturers in the context of increasing war against migrants and undocumented persons in the U.S.
Well, the significance of the bill is enormous because it represents one more opportunity for the U.S. government to transfer public funds, taxes into the private sector. It gives them a huge excuse to do that. And this is unprecedented, just the amount. These sorts of transfers happen all the time, like justifications of counterterrorism, especially, and especially in immigration enforcement after 9/11 skyrocketed, you know, like in mission statements of the U.S. Border Patrol and Customs and Border Protection. There's nothing really about immigration. It's all terrorism. We're stopping terrorists from coming into the, crossing the border, coming into the country, bringing their weapons of mass destruction. And so regularly, this is the dominant narrative of transferring, allowing to transfer this sort of huge money over and to fill these policies with contracts. And but this one is, like I said, unprecedented. It's just enormous. And when the Elbit news was reported by business press and some in the progressive media and Electronic Intifada and Alternet, Now, there's the thing that people kept missing, or at least, you know, a few mentioned it, and then others didn't mention it at all, was a single line of, from this analyst that I quoted from the original business press, Bloomberg, who said that it would, the contract of some $145 million would be expected to increase to around $1 billion if the immigration bill, the package goes through. Now, that to me is the most significant part of this news, and it was buried. And so I wanted to focus on that and report on it and just put in lots of analysis and reporting and just focus on that one point, because I feel like that is the crux of the discussion, especially that's being missed by everybody. And this is what we should be talking about, specifically Israel's role. I mean, there are lots of global actors who are helping the United States to smash undocumented migrant communities and communities of color and border communities on both borders, increasingly on the northern border, especially. It's raising to a frightening level. But Israel is a major one, which is just growing and growing and growing. So this is something that we're going to continue to see, especially if we ignore these trends, and we ignore them at our peril, unless we do something about it and stop it.
Gabe, if you could talk about what it looks like at the U.S.-Mexico border now and what this $145 million deal with Elbit Systems aims to do exactly.
Okay, well, this specific contract, it is, that's something, a good question to recognize at first as well. It's one contract by one company at one place in the border so far. Arizona is the initial area where these integrated fixed towers, they're like sensor-based, they're surveillance large towers, and it's part of the Customs and Border Protection's plan that Congress has approved, and it's been a long time coming. And Elbit actually beat out some major players, like U.S.-based major firms like Lockheed Martin and Boeing. So Elbit is already big. It's Israel's largest non-governmental private, you know, private security firm, but it's also becoming more and more of a major player here. It's major U.S. subsidiary is based in Fort Worth, Texas, called Elbit Systems of America. In fact, at the latest trade show a few weeks ago, there are these trade shows along the border where the Border Patrol in uniform, other military brass and corporate executives and other technocrats peddling their products and representing companies, some large and small, getting together in this arena to show off their products and these prototypes, and this whole arena will be filled with them. There'll be meetings going on, keynote speeches. Israeli military and corporate executives have been an increasing presence in these sorts of trade shows. And the most recent one, when you walked into the arena, is this huge banner that went across the doors as you go in. Big American flag on one side, Israeli flag on the other, and it said Elbit Systems of America, because this was right after the contract was announced, so it was perfect timing to just to give the parade the whole this like relationships that's booming specifically with Elbit. So Elbit has these towers in Arizona's the first by Nogales, which is about 60 miles or so from where I'm sitting right here in University of Arizona in Tucson in the borderlands. And then it's expected to take the integrated fixed tower project and then just expand it across the border, just like all of the other sort of systems projects, and surveillance or other types of military-style infrastructure.
That's the voice of Gabe Chivone. Gabe, you write that the surveillance systems have been battle-tested against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. Can you talk about how Palestinians have been used essentially as guinea pigs by companies such as Elbit Systems? There's also been the use of Israeli-made drones along the U.S.-Mexico border. Can you talk about both of those?
Yeah. So this is the The idea of the occupied territories as laboratory is really created, and it's been around a long time. In fact, the source that I used for that article goes back to the early 1980s when I first saw that phrase used, battle proven or battle tested. And that was reported by mainstream US media when Israel's role started to step up in Guatemala in the genocide, outright genocide of indigenous Mayan peoples, for which the general who was at the time one of the commanders during the worst part of the atrocities during the period of the United Nations Truth Commission report came out and said that between 1978 and 1984 were the was the worst period of the atrocities and the most amount of deaths. Like, if we're talking about at least 200,000 dead during the hostilities between the early 1960s to the mid 1990s, 78 through 84 was when there was the most of them amount. I mean, we're talking about 150,000 out of the 200,000 just in a 2 year period. And Efrain Rios-Montt was the general who came to power in a coup. It was touted as a bloodless coup in March of 1982. And he had an interview with ABC News in which he said that his coup was so successful because, quote, because our soldiers were trained by Israelis. And Israeli press was reporting at the time 300 Israeli advisors were on the ground helping execute that coup. And it was a lot of this was covered in a really, really good book by a couple of a scholar and a journalist named Milton Jamael and Margot Gutierrez. And the title of their book was It's No Secret: Israel's Role in Central America. And as they say in the opening pages, the reason why they named it that is because most of their sources came from US mainstream media. And this was, like they say, no secret. It was there, but it wasn't talked about. You know, like, Israel played a leading role in the genocide of this, I mean, the most horrific sorts of atrocities imaginable. And these soldiers in Guatemala were trained by Israeli. There is one military advisor that I was looking at his interview the other day, and brother and sister team Andrew and Leslie Cockburn, they wrote a book called Dangerous Liaison, and they interviewed this military advisor. And so it's one thing for Rios-Montt to say that our soldiers were trained by Israelis. It's one thing for Israeli press to report it, that 300 of them, but it's another thing to actually get it from the mouth of one of them. And they had this exclusive interview with him, and you get to see what the motivations are and why he's there. I mean, he's talking, this advisor was getting $5,000 for every 6 week contract training every single high ranking officer in the Guatemalan military, Guatemalan army, above the rank of captain. And he said that he was originally in the Israeli border guards. So that's where his job is, but he's so far away from home, but he doesn't miss his home because he found the work to be fascinating and the company congenial. And I mean, he echoing, this is a soldier on the ground, you can say, at the very bottom of the whole policy of supporting regimes, monstrous regimes like Guatemala and others who were just massacring people left and right, dissidents and indigenous people. But his sentiment echoes those at the top. You know, those at the top who are saying it's a matter of survival for the people, for the Israeli people, the Jewish people specifically. They say this kind of language to partner up with these regimes, no matter what they're doing, because it also wasn't a secret what Guatemala was doing at that time. And you'll have, like, the heads of Israeli military industries saying things like, if the state has approved of these sales to go through, my conscience is clear. I mean, that's a quote from Michael Schur. He's one of those leaders. And so this advisor says the same thing. I mean, he says, I don't care what the Gentiles do with the arms, the Gentiles being non-Jews. The main thing is that the Jews profit. You know, these sorts of really cold and calculating statements that show you, like, a frightening portrait into the motivations and the justifications for the human people on the ground making them work. And speaking about my article, that's one critique of this article that, I mean, you have in my piece. I was going over the companies and going over the contracts and going over policies and why things are. But one thing that's missing it's one thing I'm working on now is the human stories, those who are the corporate leaders, that are on the ground here in the U.S.-Mexico border, Israeli, American, who are driving this industry, and what are their motivations, and what are their words and justifications. So I'm looking into that now, and sort of where this article leaves off is where I'm what I'm looking into now. And I've had interviews with various like CEOs and vice presidents of companies who have been surprisingly willing to talk to me. I mean, I don't know if they Googled or not saw this article, but and they maybe they don't care. You know, they're getting their name out there, like the companies. And in terms of drones, the Hermes were the first batch of drones to actually fly over the borderland skies. And today, that was back in 2004. Today, according to a CBP spokesperson, Customs and Border Protection spokesperson, the Predator program, as he called it, is run by, there's wholly U.S. Predator B drones. He said that he doesn't know what happened to the Israeli Hermes drones. That's changed a little bit. It doesn't mean that like no Israeli drones will ever be again over the skies, and who knows where those original Israeli drones are right now. They could be in a warehouse somewhere or something. It doesn't. Elbit has been getting sales left and right all around the world. You know, especially in Latin America, they have some major clients there. I mean, there was just recently an arms deal they made in the Philippines. I mean, they've had, even before the Elbit contract with DHS, Department of Homeland Security, they had a recent contract with various U.S. military forces. I mean, just the other day, it was with the U.S. Army. They had a $12 million contract. But this was a big one, this $145 million. It was a major one. But they have them all the time. And Elbit is a major company, but it's really a large representative of the larger scheme of Israeli security companies that are entering more and more into the U.S. Marketplace for border security. You could call it the border security industrial complex.
Gabe, briefly, why has the Senate bill stalled in the House, and do you expect it to pass anyway?
I feel like it's anybody's guess at this point. It's really, I mean, ostensibly it's portrayed in the media, and there's some truth to it, of course. The Republican-controlled House is the one that's stalling it, and the so-called Gang of Eight is the one that wrote it. That four of them, half of them were Republicans, half of them were Democrats, and they wrote it, and that was last summer. And lots of you could even call them major liberal and mainstream immigration groups wanting immigration reform jumped on board, despite the fact of how much militarization was part of the package, so big compromise. And it hasn't been passed, you know, and it grows ever unlikely that it's going to pass at all. And in a way, it doesn't matter for Israel whether or not it's passed, because as we saw with this contract, the money's there and the justification is like continues to be there with like what direction policy, U.S. policy is moving in. And the more it really depends on the more that the domestic cost is raised by those that are organizing dissent in the streets. So, I mean, there's this national movement that I sort of like open with that has been just cropping up everywhere across the country, and it doesn't show any signs of stopping. In fact, it only promises to grow more drastic, more extreme, more traumatic to the status quo, as it should, and as it looks like it will, even just Obama like does something. I mean, he doesn't need Congress. He can stop deportations tomorrow. You know, I mean, there are so many things that can happen.
All right, well, we're going to leave it right there, but we are encouraging our listeners to go to the Electronic Intifada and read Gabe's article how Israel's war industry profits from violent U.S. immigration reform. Gabe Chavone, thank you so much for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thanks a lot. Good to be here.
On April 9th, Palestinians all over the world commemorated the 66th anniversary of the Deir Yassin massacre, when Zionist militias invaded and attacked the small village near Jerusalem in 1948, killing more than 100 people. Dina Elmouti's grandmother was a child survivor of the massacre. Elmouti tells her story to the Electronic Intifada.
My grandmother is the survivor of the Deir Yassin massacre. 66 years later, her scars still bear witness. Deir Yassin is a name permanently inscribed in the Palestinian narrative. Friday, April 9th, 1948, is a date forever engraved with infamy. The Deir Yassin massacre is a turning point in Palestinian history, remaining a symbol of dispossession, ongoing erasure, and humanity's capacity for cruelty. When I was in Palestine this summer, my grandmother pointed to the stone home in Deir Yassin, where she was born 76 years ago, and my eyes caught a glimpse of a pale scar on her arm. The nostalgia in her voice was so strong, I could almost see the barbaric scenes of terror as if they were being projected from a movie reel onto a screen in front of us. Today, a psychiatric hospital occupies the center of Deir Yassin's village, restricting access to its fortified stone homes, standing out defiantly against the grid of generic Israeli settlement buildings constructed on stolen land. The village was once home to around 750 people, located outside Jerusalem and a few hundred meters to the west of the Jewish-only settlement of Givat Shaul. It was known for its peaceful reputation and primary industry of stone quarrying. By sunrise on April 9th, the Zionist terrorist organization, known as the Irgun and Stern Gang, had raided the village and stormed homes, slaughtering as many people as possible. The victims included unarmed elderly men, pregnant women, and children. Large piles of smoking and charred bodies were thrown into a pit. Homes were filled with bodies, riddled with bullets, and walls were splattered with blood. Each spring, almond trees in full bloom filled the air with the sweet fragrance of their blossoms. By evening that Friday, the suffocating stench of blood and burning corpses permeated the air instead. More than 100 people were murdered that day, but the carnage was not gruesome enough for the perpetrators, who exaggerated the death toll to reporters as more than double in order to incite panic and terror throughout the country. With the motive of mass expulsion, Deir Yassin marked the implementation of the Zionist policy to terrorize and erase the indigenous people from all of Palestine, not just Jerusalem. This ultimately led to the exodus of more than 750,000 people from their homes. Today, Palestinians constitute the largest refugee population in the world at more than 5.3 million. My grandmother pointed over to a basketball court and park where the stone quarry once stood. Closing my eyes, I tried to commit the details of this place to memory. I opened my eyes to the unsettling reality of settlers standing on the balcony of my grandmother's home. There are no words to describe the agony of knowing that in order for settlers to now call this place home, they first had to erase its rightful owners from their consciousness. My father built that house, stone by stone, she said. The morning of the massacre, I raced up the steps to get Jamal from his crib. On my way down, I slipped on bullet casings, cutting my arm as we fell. Outside, she and her four younger siblings ran into their teacher, Hayat al-Balbisi, She bandaged my right arm and grabbed my left, my grandmother said. Taking Zeman from my arms, she ran towards the group of people fleeing towards the village of Ein Gedi. She instructed us to stay with the group before rushing back to help a wounded man. I looked back towards her and our home one last time. Al-Balbisi, a village teacher, established a first aid area that morning to treat wounded villagers. She helped countless people survive the massacre before a Zionist terrorist shot her in the head outside my grandmother's home. She was 18 years old. Following the massacre, refugees fled to East Jerusalem, carrying little more than the incomprehensible memory of murder and destruction. When we reunited with my mother after 3 days, she told us about how the Zionists kept her and other women prisoners in the bakery, proudly waving around large daggers wet with the blood of others, my grandmother said. My grandmother's cousin, Naziha Radwan, was 6 at the time of the massacre. She survived by covering herself in her grandmother's blood, hiding beneath stiffened bodies and pretending to be dead. Walking along the dirt path, my grandmother pointed to the home of her paternal aunt, Besma Zahran, and recounted another tragedy. She and her 4 children were shot, and their bodies were burned in there, my grandmother said. 3 little girls and a newborn baby boy, only a few hours old. Shaking her head in disbelief, she added, prior to the massacre, we were on good terms with the Jews in Givat Shaul. We shared food, celebrated together, paid condolences to one another, babysat for each other. There was peace here before the Zionists came and destroyed everything. A gentle breeze filled the air as we picked almonds from the tree my great-grandfather planted. I felt reawakened by the palpable bond to this land which remains unbreakable and non-negotiable. Disturbed by the sight, a settler came over and demanded to know what we were doing. The irony of this was not lost on my grandmother. I'm picking almonds from my tree, my grandmother said, planted outside my home. The settler left quietly, shrinking in my grandmother's presence. Moments like these remind me that not only tragedy permeates the soil here, but also hope. Palestine was never an empty land without a people, and it never will be. Aggressors assume that survivors will forget. They fool themselves more than anyone else. Our narratives remain indestructibly woven into the fabric of our existence, grafted onto our bones and configured into our DNA, passed down from generation to generation. We will never forget what happened in Deir Yassin on April 9, 1948. We will keep on telling our stories.
That was Dina Elmouti reading her piece, The Scars of Deir Yassin and Our Determination to Survive. You can read it and see photographs of Elmouti's grandmother in Deir Yassin on electronicintifada.net. And that's it for our weekly Electronic Intifada podcast. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, and pointed opinion and analysis by our team of correspondents and bloggers, visit us online at electronicintifada.net, where you can also post comments and sign up for our daily email digest. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and on behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.